This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
Welcome to this episode. I'm Simon McKenzie, a research fellow in the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the UQ Law School. Today we're going to be discussing the concept of autonomy in weapons systems, what it is, why it's important, and how it should be understood for the purposes of the law of armed conflict. To help us through this, I'm joined by my colleague Dr. Tim McFarlane, also from the UQ Law School. There's really no one better to help us with this question. Tim's just published a book, Autonomous Weapon Systems and the Law of Armed Conflict, which was put out by Cambridge University Press earlier this year. He received his PhD from the Melbourne Uni and has a background in engineering, so he brings technical understanding to our conversations about law. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks very much, Simon. Very happy to be here.
So what is autonomy?
Well, that's a short question with quite a long answer. Very simply, autonomy refers to a capacity for self-management or self-governance. We say a machine is autonomous when it can do whatever it's designed to do without necessarily needing a human to issue every command and guide it every step of the way. In the context of weapon systems, we say an autonomous weapon could be any type of weapon like a missile or an aircraft or a tank, which is controlled not manually by a human operator, but by a computer built into the weapon system running some very advanced software which enables that weapon to be deployed on an operation and potentially do things like search for targets, decide whether conditions are right to engage those targets and even carry out an attack without necessarily needing any intervention from a human at any point.
So it sounds like there's a big range of systems that you might think of as autonomous. Just to sort of push on that a little bit, what would be at the lower end of autonomy that could still be described as autonomous when it comes to weapon systems?
So I should flag that the exact, I guess, scope of what is encompassed by autonomy is still a matter of some discussion amongst people who are debating how to regulate autonomous weapons. But my view is that autonomy is a fairly, I guess, broadly available capability. There are many existing weapons, some as simple as landmines, that could be described as autonomous. If you think of how a mine works, once it's emplaced in the ground and activated, from that point on, it doesn't need any human intervention in order to fulfill its purpose. It can wait in the ground with whatever type of trigger mechanism it has, whether it's a pressure plate or some other system. And when a target engages with the weapon system...
So it treads on the mine?
Yeah, treads on the mine. that trigger mechanism can be activated and the mine can explode. And there's no human intervention needed at any point there once the mine's in place. So it qualifies as autonomous. It's not necessarily what people would generally think of as being autonomous. We usually think of more complex system.
So what's an example of a more complex system? I know you gave one of the tanks, but are there existing weapon systems that have degrees of autonomy?
Yeah, there certainly are. I guess the most well-known examples would be the point defense weapons like SeaWiz systems. So gun turrets that are mounted on ships or vehicles or statically at the military bases. And their job is to use radar to scan for incoming attacks, whether missiles or aircraft or something else, and automatically aim and fire at that incoming munition and destroy it. And the idea is that happens more accurately and more quickly than a human would be able to select and fire upon those targets. And so that's the contribution that the autonomous control system makes in that respect.
And so I guess the mine's recognizing the target through the pressure placed on the ground. How do the SeaWizzes recognize what they can fire at and what they can't?
They essentially use radar systems. SeaWiz have been used since the late 1970s, I believe, were the earliest ones. Obviously become a lot more advanced over the years, but essentially they use radar to detect and track incoming targets and to aim the gun and fire upon them.
So they would see something moving in a way that was similar to all the other missiles that had or fit the category of missile in terms of the speed, the size, that sort of thing?
Yeah, essentially they're programmed with a description or a set of criteria about what constitutes an incoming attack, what fits the profile of a target that needs to be fired upon, and they'll be able to automatically recognize that and aim and fire if it's detected.
So you've given us two examples of existing weapon systems or defensive weapon systems that have degrees of autonomy. So with them in mind, like why is autonomy important for the legal debate? Why is it something that is the focus of research and political debate?
Well, I guess the broader issue is that any new class of weapon system needs to be examined carefully for its ability to be used in compliance with the law of armed conflict. That's always a background issue that needs to be addressed. Autonomy, it in particular, raises some specific concerns in that in some cases it seems to, I guess, undermine some of the assumptions that the law of armed conflict is based on, insofar as an autonomous weapon can operate without necessarily needing a human to guide it or with less human interaction. It sometimes calls into question the role of the human being in controlling those weapons and in being accountable for those weapons. The law that we have today places a lot of emphasis, essentially operates by assigning obligations to human combatants in the deploying of weapons and operation of weapons during an armed conflict. And when the weapon in question is able to operate with less human interaction, it raises questions about exactly how the law operates.
So let's get a little bit more specific. What are some of the legal obligations that an autonomous weapon might struggle with, or that people think they might struggle with?
Okay, so at the moment, there's no law directed specifically at autonomous weapons. So the principles in question are those that apply to the use of any weapon system. Those are defined under general IHL.
So that's international humanitarian law?
Yeah, international humanitarian law. I guess the perhaps major focus of discussion in regulatory circles so far has been about respecting the principle of distinction. And that's the principle that states that attacks must only ever be directed against combatants and against military targets, never against civilians or civilian objects. And there's a number of rules defined in various IHL treaties and in customary law that support observance of that principle. And one of the main concerns that have been expressed about autonomous weapons is whether and how exactly they would be able to observe the principle of distinction. You can imagine many complex scenarios on a battlefield. Think of urban warfare scenarios, for example, where combatants and civilians may be mixing with each other in ways that makes it difficult for even a human soldier to reliably distinguish between who's a soldier and who's a civilian. And the question that's often raised is, well, how would a computer, an autonomous weapon, make that judgment?
So I guess from what you said, the focus of people's worry is really this civilians directly participating in hostilities situation, rather than we were talking about the SeaWiz earlier, where material that they're autonomously targeting is sort of couldn't be anything else but a missile. Whereas with the focus of concern for autonomous weapon systems seems to be more about the civilians being mistaken as soldiers. Do you think that's a fair summary?
Yes, that's a fair summary of an objection that's very commonly raised in regulatory circles. I think the way to understand that concern, though, is firstly to remember that legal obligations, the obligation to respect the principle of distinction, belongs to legal persons, belongs to human beings. It doesn't belong to autonomous systems. So objections that are phrased in terms that make it seem like the machine must observe the law, like how would an autonomous weapon make that distinction, are perhaps a little bit misleading in that context. Remembering that it's the people who select a weapon system and deploy that system and the people who operate it or supervise it in conflict are the ones who bear the obligation to distinguish between combatants and civilians. And so they have an obligation to select autonomous systems that they reasonably believe or that are have been shown to be capable of operating correctly in those circumstances. I think that's a fairly common theme in the regulatory debate so far. Points that position the machine as a decision maker in some sense are quite misleading in a legal context. It's always the person who bears legal responsibilities, not the machine. The machine is just a tool that a bearer of legal responsibilities will use.
So there's another legal obligation that I think it'd be useful to introduce here. So I'm going to sort of ask you a leading question about that, Tim, and that's the requirement to take precautions. So I wondered if you could link that to what you were just saying about the legal obligations being on people who are deploying the weapons.
Okay, so yes, the obligation to take precautions are more broadly in respect of the principle of distinction or any of the other principles of IHL belongs to the attacking force, the state and the individual combatants, in particular more senior commanders, who will select a particular weapon system for use in a particular attack and will define the constraints that weapon is subject to, so the time at which it's activated, the space in which it's allowed to operate, the type of civilian activity known to be occurring in the area. All of those constraints have to be considered and applied by people who select a particular weapon system to be used in an attack, and it's those people who must be sure that the weapon is able to function adequately in that environment.
So just to change tack in our conversation a little bit, I wondered if you could talk about how autonomy is understood in the debates about weapon systems and about the regulation of weapon systems. We've sort of hinted at that through our conversation so far, but I think one of the key contributions that your book and previous works made is about really clarifying what we mean when we're talking about autonomy, or what we should mean when we're talking about autonomy. So what are some of the range of ways that autonomy is understood in the debate currently, and why are they not as good as they could be?
Yes, it's been one of the unfortunate hallmarks of the regulatory debate so far that even after, 7 years or so of meetings under the auspices of the United Nations, states parties are still arguing or still disagreeing about what exactly an autonomous weapon is, how autonomy should be understood, and what would be the scope of any regulatory measures that are taken. There's quite a spectrum of views on this matter. On one end is a very simple mechanical view of autonomy that simply refers to a machine that's run by a programmable computer that allows the machine to do whatever it's designed to do without necessarily needing a human to issue instructions. At the other end of the spectrum, some states, some commentators propose very advanced, complex, almost anthropomorphic views of what an autonomous system is. They seem to take views of autonomy that are maybe more appropriate to other fields, like the way that autonomy is referred to in law or philosophy, to refer to systems that can make up their own minds about their goals and the rules they follow to achieve those goals, and can operate without being subject to any outside influence at all, almost like a human would.
We're almost seeing here the influence of science fiction framing the debate, and the campaign against autonomous weapons is the campaign against killer robots. And so I think that there's a way in which the model that people have in their heads of what an autonomous weapon system is like RoboCop or Terminator, rather than some of the things that we were talking about before.
Yeah, that's very true. And if you just search through popular press for any articles about autonomous weapons, there's a pretty good chance there'll be a picture of a Terminator or RoboCop or something attached to it. And that image, unfortunately, has found its way into the debate. It's quite understandable. Autonomy is a complex field. Machine autonomy is a complex area, and the state of the art is changing very rapidly, and it can be quite difficult to understand exactly what the capabilities of autonomous machines are today, and even more so what they're likely to be in years to come. And so it is sensible to be cautious about the development path that technology might take, but you also need to be realistic about the capabilities of systems today and what's likely to be possible in years to come. I guess the important thing to remember from a regulatory perspective is that regardless of how complex or how capable a machine might become, it still is just a machine. It still is just a platform like a tank or a ship or something that's run by a fancy computer rather than directly by a human, and that doesn't change even though its capabilities might expand.
So I guess in your vision of autonomy, you're not talking about a conscious computer that's sort of achieved some self-awareness or some kind of capacity to be responsible itself.
No, not at all. It's still just a machine that's programmed to do a particular task. And certainly though the task that it might be programmed to do can be expected to become more complex as years pass, as technologies progress, but it still is an artifact and a tool that's developed and programmed and operated by people. It's not a being that you should consider to be an independent decision maker in any sense.
Mm-hmm. So would you describe this sort of a technical view of autonomy, or how would you characterize the way that you describe autonomy as opposed to other contributors to the debate who rely on more legal or philosophical notions?
Yeah, it certainly is a technical view. I think it's important to remember that the phrase itself, autonomous weapon system, is not autonomous is not a description that was chosen by lawyers or philosophers. It was chosen by the scientists and engineers who have developed these systems as a means of describing the capability that they were imparting to these systems, and it has to be understood in that sense. Autonomy is about enabling the thing to manage itself, not to make it an independent being.
So you're almost suggesting there that it's like a mistaken or lost in translation between one set of experts and another, that when lawyers or philosophers hear autonomy, they're hearing something different than the scientists who are, or technology developers that are, I don't know, developing the CWIS system or developing the more advanced autonomous systems. Is this sort of how you see the debate?
Perhaps. I guess the reasons underlying different viewpoints can be complex. Perhaps people are picturing, I guess, different levels of development of autonomous systems and maybe thinking of further ahead of what could hypothetically be possible in the future versus what is likely to be possible in the near future. It's difficult to say exactly how views are formed, but the fact that there are quite a wide range of views being put forward in the debate is certainly becoming problematic, in that it's difficult to see how any regulatory effort can really move forward until all the parties in the debate agree on essentially what it is that we're trying to regulate.
So you argue in your work that autonomy is a kind of form of control. So I wondered if you could explain this sort of head on. What do you mean by autonomy as a form of control?
So if you maybe take an example of a piloted aircraft being deployed on an operation, maybe to fly a sortie over some area and engage a target if that's appropriate. In that context, it's the human pilot who is responsible for assessing the circumstances of the operation, for identifying targets, along with whatever other personnel might be involved in running the operation, of course. And it's those people who are responsible for ultimately selecting a target and firing upon it if that's appropriate. If we replace that piloted aircraft with an autonomous aerial platform, we're not giving up the ability to do those tasks, to select and assess targets and to evaluate whether it's appropriate to attack them or not. We're just using software, a pre-programmed computer system, to do those tasks on our behalf. So the type of the control that would have been exercised by human personnel during the operation is still being exercised, but instead it was done in advance effectively by the people who designed and developed and programmed the weapon platform and its control system, rather than by people on the spot during the operation. So there's still control being applied in the sense that the computer that's operating that autonomous platform is still ensuring that the operation proceeds as per plans that have been made previously. There just happens to be no humans who are needed during the operation.
So if we were to adopt your view of autonomy, or the states parties in the UN discussions were to adopt your view, how do you think this would change the legal debate?
Well, there are quite a few participants in the debate who do either implicitly or explicitly adopt a fairly technical view of autonomy. I think what's needed is perhaps more consensus. I note in the last couple of sessions, there's a general consensus forming around the idea that the type and nature of human intervention or human control that's available overall in respect of an autonomous operation is the critical consideration from a regulatory perspective, and I think that's a good thing. I wouldn't advocate for, I guess, one specific strict view of autonomy. What's really needed is consensus about what needs to be regulated and the scope of machines that could be considered autonomous, and that view needs to be grounded in reality. But as for the particular content of it, I think that's what states need to decide amongst themselves.
So, Tim, what parts of the sort of developments of autonomous weapon systems are you worried about? What do you think the legal debate should focus on? Like, where should we be devoting our energies when it comes to legal scholarship, or sort of where should we be looking?
So my view is that autonomy doesn't add anything that's fundamentally new to a weapon system. As we noted before, we have weapon systems that have been in use for decades that could be considered autonomous, certainly on the simpler end of the spectrum, but still autonomous. I don't think increases in complexity and capability over the coming years will fundamentally change that. What it will change, though, is that we will quickly reach areas where it might be difficult to thoroughly test test an autonomous system to decide how it will behave in chaotic conditions on a battlefield. We're already encountering that in some fields in respect of testing complex software systems. There are many unsolved technical challenges to be met. I think in many fields it's generally acknowledged that it's no longer possible to exhaustively test very complex software to understand every aspect of how it'll behave in a real situation.
So can you just unpack that a little bit more for me, Tim? Like, why is it difficult to test complex software system? What is the barrier to it?
In part, it's because the algorithms or the decision processes that are employed in large software systems can be extremely complex in themselves. And because there are so many different variables at play, that the number of states that the system can get itself into can just be a very, very huge number, and it's just impossible to exhaustively look at every last detail of every different thing that could change to affect the state of that system. And in the case of weapon systems in particular, the chaotic conditions that can be realized on a battlefield, especially when you're operating against an intelligent adversary who is perhaps actively trying to disrupt your operation, it's very difficult for people in charge of testing to anticipate everything that could possibly happen on a battlefield. And if they can't anticipate it, then they can't really test their systems for how they'll behave in the face of that thing. So it's partly knowledge about what sort of conditions the systems may be subject to, and it's partly the complexity of the systems themselves. Together, it makes it very difficult to test every possible thing that could happen during an operation.
And do you think it would be is that an impediment to deploying the systems, or is it just a technical issue to resolve?
Seems to me it's more of a technical issue to resolve. Every weapon needs to be tested for its ability to be used in compliance with the law, and of course every commander wants to know that the weapon system that they're deploying will behave in a certain way on the battlefield. So this testing challenge has to be met in respect of every weapon. Autonomous systems are no different in that respect. What needs to be developed are perhaps the technical means to address that new level of risk, that new level of complexity, and I think that's an unsolved challenge that will have to be met soon, before the technology develops too much further.
And do you think it will change how weapons users will have to sort of monitor their weapons over time, or will it be a kind of same relationship between the user and the weapon?
Well, that depends very much on the development path that technology takes. One of the motives for increasing levels of autonomy in weapons is to enable them to be deployed in, longer-term operations, to have them loitering in an area over long terms, to develop persistent intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance capabilities that can establish, you know, patterns of life and detailed information about what's happening over the battlefield over long time frames. And to undertake those sorts of operations, it certainly seems like it would be difficult to keep very close supervision over a weapon system through the entirety of an operation. So there would have to be some means of establishing trust that a weapon will continue to behave as it's been programmed to behave over time. And that's another technical challenge that needs to be met.
Some complex things to grapple with. So to finish up, Tim, I wondered if you could tell me what you've been working on recently and what's the sort of next projects are for you after finishing your book.
So most of my work recently has been engaging with the regulatory discussions taking place in the United Nations at the moment. There are some, as I said before, there's some signs of a loose consensus that the type and degree of human control is the critical element for regulatory purposes. So I've been trying to engage with that growing consensus and form a more detailed view about exactly what type, what the content of adequate human control would be to govern autonomous operations.
So just what is the range of views on the level of human control? Like, is there, because different states have different perspectives, or if that's the critical question, where are the parameters of that?
Yeah, so as we noted before, we see autonomy as a form of control. Some states have engaged very much with that view, and they have taken, I'll tentatively say, they've saying that a more hands-off approach can be acceptable, that as long as the weapon system is tested and known to operate as it's intended to operate in the circumstances of the attack, then it's acceptable if humans aren't available to interact with the weapon in real time during an operation. It's acceptable if they aren't necessarily able to intervene at every moment during an operation. While other states have taken a more cautious view, and they look at human control very much in terms of that human intervention, the ability to intervene at any time to correct errors or to change the course of an operation. And again, there's quite a spectrum of views between those two.
Well, I think that's all the questions I had. I mean, we could keep on talking for longer, but I think you've given us a really great introduction to some of the issues of autonomy in weapon systems. And I know that you've written some pieces for our website, as well as some of the journal articles that you've been putting out recently that I'm sure people can explore if they want to learn more. But thanks so much for joining us, Tim. This has been really interesting.
Thank you, Simon. It's been great to be here.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.